While we're turning to the text, maybe you can put a picture up of Scott and Shauna so that you know who they are. I think it's there somewhere, Randy, I think, hey? Nope. It's not there. We'll have it there next week for you. So, if you can take your Bibles, please, and turn to the book of 1 Chronicles. Chapter 11. We're not going to read the text, but I will certainly refer to the story, beginning around verse 10 and going all the way to the end of the chapter. We'll be touching on points in there. 1 Chronicles 11. The saying goes that the captain should always go down with his ship. Captains are weaned on that. They cut their teeth on that, and many have lost their lives believing that that is the way they are to live. If the ship goes down, the captain is to go down with it. And yet, even if a captain does not buy into the notion that he should go down with a ship, none would agree that the captain should be the first off a sinking ship. That is with the exception of former Captain Francesco Schettino, who a year ago steered his cruise ship, the Costa Concordia, too close to the island of Giglio, while trying to show off, and a boulder tore into the side of his ship, and as it moved into harbor, it ended up turning on its side and sinking. Infrared video of the evacuation that was captured by the Italian Coast Guard shows hundreds of people trying to get off the ship as it was at that angle, and of rescue workers trying desperately to help get them into lifeboats with only moonlight to guide them by that time. By then, however, Captain Schettino was already on dry land. Not only had he run into a boulder showing off and destroyed his ship, but he had abandoned it and all those on deck in a time of great peril. 32 people died in that shipwreck, and Schettino is facing counts of manslaughter, which is horrible, and of abandoning ship, which is one of the ultimate symbols, I suppose, of shame and disloyalty. When I heard the news of that this week and that he was going to go on trial and secretly hoping that he gets convicted of it, I wondered whether his actions were just not more a sign of the times than anything else. The times in which disloyalty and betrayal seem far more common than loyalty does. In so many settings, in churches and businesses and jobs, loyalty has waned. And you can see it. If you've retired, you know that you got a job at one point and perhaps were with a company for 30 years and then you retired. That just doesn't happen anymore. On the other side, with some companies, you have the job security that's pretty much equal to an NFL head coach at the end of the season if you happen to end up in the bottom third of the pack, right? And many have found that without a team of lawyers, an agreement is not worth the paper it's written on, and a handshake is worth even less. Every betrayal has an alibi, every scheme has a fall guy, and we can end up with a really clouded perspective on how life works and what loyalty really means. But if we were to see what loyalty looks like, what would that be? If we wanted to live a loyal life, what would we be doing? Well, in the interest of helping us understand what loyalty looks like and desiring to live it because it is, in fact, a reflection of the character and actions of God, I want us to look at this story today in chapter 11, because in it we have four descriptions of what loyalty looks like, which we can hopefully learn from and try to emulate, and one picture of what disloyalty looks like that we can hopefully learn from and refuse to follow. The first First, we see the characteristics of what loyalty looks like in David's mighty men, 1 Chronicles 11. According to verses 15 and 25, David had 30 mighty men. And over top of the 30, he had three who were his chief men. The chronicler describes them this way in verse 10. Now these are the heads of the mighty men whom David had, who gave him strong support in his kingdom, together with all Israel, to make him king according to the word of the Lord concerning Israel. So the historian is about to describe men who influenced and had power and helped David get into his position as king. But before we look at them, we need to orient ourselves in terms of the time in which their story occurred. The first 10 chapters of first 10 verses of chapter 11 speak about David being acclaimed as king by all of Israel, of him taking the city of Jerusalem and conquering it, and it becoming his city, the city of David. And then what the historian does is this. He's been talking about the story of David becoming king. But now that he's got the city and now that he's got the crown, he stops and he looks back at the lives of those who helped David become what he was. Okay? And what we see in their actions are four descriptions of loyalty. So in 1 Chronicles 11, verse 11, the chronicler goes back to a time when David had been anointed by Samuel as king over Israel, but he was really king over nothing. The present king Saul was pursuing him, hoping to kill him, and the territory in which David was hiding was entirely under the control of the archenemies of Israel, the Philistines. And David is holed up in a cave called the Cave of Adullam, at this time in his life, far more of a fugitive than he was a king. And yet, as I said before, he had managed to gather to himself 30 mighty men, remarkable warriors, and over top of them had appointed three chief men, the bravest of the brave, the strongest of the strong, the mightiest of the mighty. And what the historian does here is he decides that before he's going to tell us a story about what all three of them did together, he's first going to tell us a story of what two of them did individually. Okay? And in each one of these individual stories, there is a picture of what loyalty looks like. The first of David's mighty men that's mentioned is a man named Jashobeam, the son of Hashmonite. He was the chief of the 30. So in other words, this would have probably made him equivalent to David's minister of war. And yet he didn't earn his stars and stripes by sitting in an air-conditioned room in the rear echelon plotting battle strategy on a map with pins. No, he earned his credentials and the right to be the minister of war on the field of battle. You see that at the end of verse 11 where it says that he lifted up his spear against 300 whom he killed at one time. At one time. So this is not a lifetime achievement award for him, but rather it is a noteworthy day in the life of this warrior who probably had some pretty good other days that didn't quite reach 300. That may well have been the day when David said, you know what, you are going to be the chief guy over everyone else. And in his behavior, we see the first description of loyalty. And it is this, that loyal people fight aggressively for their cause. Loyal people will fight aggressively for their cause. They will aggressively petition government to change legislation. They will aggressively picket businesses for higher wages. They will write letters ad nauseum, use social media to rally large, almost spontaneous protests. They will push on doors of bureaucracy until they get coverage for a sick child or a disabled parent, they will yell into any microphone available about their cause, and if necessary, it may come to blows, and they're fine with that. Loyal people fight aggressively for their cause. That's the first characteristic of loyalty. Then the chronicler moves on to speak of David's second mighty man, his second musketeer, so to speak. And in his life, with the little that we're told, we see a second characteristic of loyalty. It says that in verse 12, after Joshabim was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, poor guy, the Ahohite. As his story goes, in verse 13, he and David and a number of other Israelites were in a place called Pastamim. When the Philistine gathered there to battle, and there was a plot of ground there full of barley. Now, the Philistines' thinking should be fairly obvious and understandable at this point. A ripe crop grown by our enemies, why should we not steal it for ourselves? Furthermore, they would know that a hungry people is a weak people and a conquerable people, so the field was either to be scavenged for food for themselves, or barring the ability to do that, it was to be destroyed rather than feed Israel. What David had probably not counted on is that those who were with him fled before the Philistines. Maybe they said, let them have the barley. I'm going to save my bacon in a kosher sort of way. Had there been David's mighty men there, they would not have fled. But the chances are good that these were conscripted merchants and farmers who were there to fight, and they didn't know how to fight. They could tell you how to grow barley. They could tell you how to sell barley. They had no idea how to protect barley. And so they left it to those who knew how to fight, meaning just David and Eleazar, who had to face this Philistine horde alone, two against many. Yet according to verse 14, David and Eleazar took their stand. They planted their feet in the middle of that plot of land and struck down the Philistines, and the Lord gave them a great victory. And the second characteristic of loyalty that you can see in the behavior of Eleazar is this. Loyal people refuse to abandon you even when you are fighting against overwhelming odds. They refuse to abandon you even though you are fighting against overwhelming odds. You know, I would imagine that with every person that Eleazar saw leave the field, the temptation for him to do the same would increase. Because with every person who left, the chances of him dying were multiplying. And yet it doesn't seem to be that way with him. Even though people were leaving, it seems as if he had a resolve that he would not become one of them. And so he took his stand beside David because loyal people refuse to abandon you even when you're fighting against overwhelming odds. When your family, when your friends, when your church, when your company are attacked, loyal people will go to bat for you or for them in a way that is surprisingly passionate. Heaven help the person who attacks you when you have that kind of a loyal person on your side, because they will not back down. But they will, if necessary, hand the enemy their butts in a sling as they live out their loyalty to you. Now, in the Chronicles text, we're not told the name of the third mighty man. What we're told is that in verse 15, we're told a story about the three of them. So let's just name the third one. We can have Joshabim, Eleazar, and what's his name? Okay? Joshabim, what's his name, and Eleazar went down in verse 15 to the rock to David into the cave of Adullam while the army of the Philistines was camping at Rephaim. David was then in the stronghold while the garrison of the Philistines was in Bethlehem. Again, in terms of time, this is before David is king. Geographically, David was holed up at the cave of Adullam, which, if it is here, Bethlehem was 7 miles to the west of that, and the garrison of the Philistines was here, and then this whole area to the south and to the west, and east even, of where David was where the army of the Philistines was posted. So he was surrounded by them. And he was at the cave of Adullam. Now, I would imagine that the cave had a water supply. But with all the minerals and stuff that caves tend to attract, the water was probably warm and brackish tasting. It would be still rather than flowing water. And the text tells us that one day David emerged from the cave and just kind of sighed and said, "It would sure be wonderful if I could get a drink from the well inside the gate of the town of Bethlehem." You know, it was probably just nostalgic thinking on his part. He was tired of being pursued. He was tired of hiring. He was tired of eating bad food. And he was tired of choking down bad water. And yet, as he reflected back on his boyhood days, he knew he was born there in Bethlehem. He could have drank some of that great water anytime he wanted. It was nostalgia. There are places where I've lived, particularly in Saskatchewan, where that stated wish for a drink of local water would never come out of your mouth. Especially not more than once. The first place where I served as senior pastor was a town called Lipton. I'm not sure how it got its name. It was not known for tea or soup. But the local tap water did have some fame attached to it, in that it contained so many minerals and so much iron that just a small cup of that could take anything that was solid in your entire GI tract and turn it to liquid in a matter of minutes. So I never wake up in the morning and crawl out of my man cave and say, "I am just dying for a drink of water from the tap inside the town of Lipton." Maybe I'm dying because of it, but I'm certainly not dying for it. On the other hand, if you grew up in the Rocky Mountains and you tasted that water that melted from the snow up high and tumbled down those mountains, clear, cold, side effect free, and you had that refreshing water growing up and have tasted some bad stuff since, you might understand what David felt. That's probably what he was expressing, is this nostalgia for the great water that was there compared to what he had now. Not only was it wishful nostalgia for a better day, there must have been a desperate look forward as well as he said these words. He knew that God had promised him the entire land and that he would be king over it all. And so if he could have just gone to Bethlehem and drawn some water out of that well, that promise that seemed so far away, and with the enemies all around, perhaps unfathomable, would be just that much closer to being realized. Wishful nostalgia, and a wish that God's promise would be fulfilled now. Well, at least one of David's chief men heard what he said that day. And a conversation started between the three of them. One of them saying something like, "Did you hear that? Did you hear what the king said he would like?" "What was that?" "Well, he was just talking to himself and he said he would really like a drink from the well inside the town of Bethlehem." Somehow they overheard it. And then you catch another characteristic of loyalty, which is this: that loyal people are attentive to the words of the one that they are loyal to. An attentiveness to what the person says. Does that mean that you never forget what you've been told? I certainly hope not. But there is certainly a measurably higher level of attentiveness from one who is loyal to you than one who is not. Attentiveness. The king wants a drink from the well inside the gate of the town of Bethlehem. Perhaps another one said, you know, I'm getting cabin fever, cave fever, sitting around, sleeping underground. Why don't we go get it for him? And what follows is the fourth scene in the picture of what loyalty looks like, and it is this. It is a willingness to sacrifice for them. To be loyal to someone is to sacrifice for them. In this case, in the case of these men, it meant a 7-mile hike under the blazing sun. What is more, from the way I described the situation, this was not a leisurely walk among the enemies to get there. They would have had sentries posted. They would have had patrols going through the territory. Furthermore, they were going to the exact place where there were a number of their best soldiers located. The garrison of the Philistines was in Bethlehem at that time. And if that was not enough, if you're in a state of war in an arid country, in a desert, there are two places in any town or city that you own that you will protect above all else: the town gate and the town well. Because if the first is breached and you lose control of the second, you will die. Suffice it, therefore, to say that the gate to get inside of Bethlehem and the well inside of Bethlehem must have been the most highly guarded parts of the entire town. And yet, somehow, these three mighty men manage to elude or conquer Philistine patrols, to make it to Bethlehem, to somehow get through the gate. Maybe two of them are fighting while the other is cranking desperately on the well so they can fill the skin with water. And then, without being killed or caught or followed, they manage to make their way back to David's cave, another 7 miles through enemy territory under the heat of the sun. Perhaps you can imagine them approaching David when they get back, sweaty, exhausted, out of breath, probably more in need of that drink of water than he is at this point. They're tough, hardened men, but maybe they were a little more like children who had invested everything they had to give the ultimate gift for a parent. And they give the skin of water to David and they tell their story of danger and excitement. Their camaraderie is obvious as their bravery and generosity. They sacrificed for the cause because they were loyal to him. But David's response is really odd at first. And it shows us one of two ways that you can respond to loyalty that is shown to you. At first, it seems really different. David receives the skin and he finds his face flushed. And then he takes that water and he pours it all out on the ground so that it forms a puddle that soon from the heat evaporates, or because of the sand it sinks in, and soon you don't even know that it was ever there. What's with that? What do you do about these covert tactics? What about the danger? What about the risk to their lives? David kind of says that's the exact point. I'm not worthy of this. You men got this water by risking your lives at the cost of blood. I can't drink water like that. I'm not worthy of it. And the Hebrew literally says that David pours the water out as a libation. Not a waste, a libation, which is a drink offering to God. He took their loyalty that was offered to him and he offered it up to God, to whom all loyalty ultimately belongs. You know, I've been around Christian people, Christian leaders long enough to know that there are those people and leaders who appreciate the loyalty given to them by others, and they try their best to reflect that loyalty to God in different sorts of forms, because it's to Him it ultimately belongs, and from Him that it ultimately comes. Then again, I've met some, too many in fact, Christian people and leaders who, when offered a skin of water purchased at the cost of blood, respond by wondering where the ice cubes are. If we have integrity of heart, we take the loyalty that is offered to us by others in any relationship, and we reflect that somehow back to God as the one deserving ultimate loyalty. When they saw David pour that out, they knew exactly what he was doing, that he was offering it to God. It's small wonder that they followed him with such passion. Now I know how we look at a list of biblical names. Sometimes we just don't. And after reading the first 10 chapters of 1 Chronicles, full of names, they can easily just become a blur and we just naturally skip over them. I mean, they're so hard to pronounce, strange. So that by the time you would get down to, say, verse 40 of 1 Chronicles 11, you've already plodded through this list of David's mighty men and all of their relatives, it seems. And so you get to the odd names like Ira the Ithrite and Gareb the Ithrite. But then you might get smacked by the first name of the next verse. It's another of David's mighty men who helped him become everything he was. Uriah the Hittite. Why did the historian have to put that name in there? Ruin a perfectly good list of obscure and forgettable names. Taint the loyal record of the royal king that way. I mean, he could have left it out of convenience for appearance sake. But there it is. Uriah the Hittite. No story told, just a name dropped. But that's enough if you know the story, isn't it? Whereas the story of the skin looks back in David's life before he was king, this story looks forward in time. By now, David is well established as king. In fact, he's at the height of his fame. And when other kings go off to war, maybe he had a little too much fame and he decided to stay home. He saw a woman, Bathsheba, bathing, and he coveted her, committed adultery with her, and to his utter dismay, discovered that she was pregnant. And yet David, always the man in control, saw that her husband was sent back immediately from the front line of the battle, because he knew that if he could get him into bed with his pretty young wife, he could cover up what had happened, and he would think the child was his. And perhaps you know that Bathsheba's husband was Uriah the Hittite, one of David's loyal, mighty men. So loyal, in fact, that he refused to go along with David's plan. Twice David tried to get him to go home. Second time he got him drunk to try and lower his sense of duty. But Uriah says, "How can I go home and lie with my wife when my men are lying on the ground and dying in battle? I cannot be disloyal to them and enjoy the comforts of home." He was so loyal to the cause, so loyal to his men, so loyal to David that instead he stood sentry duty at the palace of the king who had just impregnated his wife. Now David's desperate. He sends Uriah back to the front lines of the war with orders in his hand that were basically orders for his own death. He was to take them to Joab, the commanding general, and the order said, Joab, take Uriah and put him where the battle is the fiercest and the enemy troops the most skilled, and then retreat the flanks from around him so that he will be killed. And David's plan worked. Uriah was killed along with some other valiant men. Not only did David commit adultery, he committed premeditated murder as planned, as if he had taken a dagger and pushed it into Uriah's heart himself. And here we see the opposite way in which we can handle the loyalty, that being that we betray it. We betray their loyalty. Whereas before David took the loyalty of his three chief men and poured it out as a holy offering before God, he took the loyalty of Uriah and he poured it out like sewer water, trivializing his devotion and betraying one of his best men to certain death. With the sinfulness around us in our world, sometimes even in the church, I get a feeling sometimes that we are far more familiar with the second response to loyalty than we are with the first. Far more familiar with betrayal than we are with loyalty. Years ago, during one of my first years of teaching at Briarcrest, as a part of an assignment, a freshman girl wrote this. I had asked them to describe their church. She said, in my old church that I've now left, someone started a rumor about me that I'd been sleeping around. I swear this never happened, but many people in the church heard it and believed it. Neither of the pastors believed me or gave me a chance to defend myself, and therefore my parents also turned away from me. It was the worst time of my life, and I tried suicide. Many are far more familiar with betrayal than loyalty. But the good news, the gospel today, is that although we may have family, friends, fellow believers who live like that, we do not have a God like that. Dr. Richard Seltzer, in his book Mortal Lessons, Notes on the Art of Surgery, writes this. I stand by the bed where a young woman lies, her face postoperative, her mouth twisted in palsy and clownish. A tiny twig of her facial nerve, the one to the muscles of her mouth, has been severed, and she will be this way from now on. The surgeon had followed with religious fervor the curve of her cheek. I promise you that. Nevertheless, to remove the tumor from her cheek, I had to cut that little nerve. Her husband is in the room. He stands on the opposite side of the bed, and together they seem to dwell in the evening lamplight, isolated from me in private. The woman speaks. Will my mouth always be like this? She asks. Yes, I say it will. It's because the nerve was cut. She nods and is silent. But the young man smiles. I like it, he says. It's kind of cute. And unmindfully he bends to kiss her crooked mouth so close that I can see how he twists his own lips to accommodate hers, to show her that the kiss still works. Seltzer concludes, he says, I hold my breath and let the wonder in. That's the loyal love of a husband, becoming like his wife to show his love. And the Bible tells us that the Word, Jesus Christ, became flesh and dwelt among us. And it was because of God's loyal love to us that David's greatest son, Jesus Christ, was born as a man. And at the cost of his life, drew waters from the well of forgiveness and salvation from which we can drink deeply and daily without cost. And we can rejoice today that we have a God and Savior who is loyal to us. Because you will never see in the list of those who have served Jesus Christ a Uriah the Hittite. You will just see God's loyal love to us in past, today, and evermore. And to respond to this loyal love that has resulted in our salvation, we can pledge our loyalty back. It takes multiple forms. The one that we're going to witness this morning is the act of public baptism, where those who are baptized will declare through their baptism their dedication and loyalty to God through this testimony of commitment. I invite you to join me and observe this as witnesses after we sing together.